and we can be. So tonight is our sixth class on Zen Mind Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi. We'll have one more class after this, and then we'll be beginning precept study for the year. And seeing as we'll only have gotten through the first third of the book, we can do this again sometime. It's been a neat source to study, provoked some very great discussions. So tonight's chapter is called No Dualism. On page 41 of the print copy. And we will read, as we have before, we'll read sections out loud. I wanted to start off first, though, by saying a little bit about form and emptiness, because he talks a lot about this in this short chapter. And it's good to know. He talks about the Prajnaparamita Sutra, that's the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. There's actually numerous Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but the best known one is the Heart Sutra, which is something that we chant regularly in our services. If you have the chant book, it's on page 22, but you don't have to look it up. And in that one, says, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So by form, the sutra means our physical form. And that is one of the five skandhas, one of the five, aggregates or five heaps, the things that just compose a human being. There's our physical body or form, there's our sensations, our person based on the, actually the six senses, including the mind, perceptions, formations are mental formations, ideas and volition, and then consciousness. So basically, whenever you read, like in a form is emptiness, like we're going to in Suzuki Roshi's chapter, just know that that is shorthand for sensations, perceptions, formations, consciousness, all of that. So all form can be short for just like all phenomena, all manifested stuff. And it's marked by emptiness, which my last podcast episode was on emptiness, number 229. Emptiness is something very specific. It's not empty of meaning. It's not empty of value. It is empty of an inherently existing self nature, inherently existing, enduring, independent self nature. It's something that we impute onto living beings, particularly onto ourselves. And the teaching is that anything that exists has no such self nature. And that doesn't mean in any way that things don't exist. They just don't exist the way we think they do. They are constantly changing. We just have no we have no fixed self nature, right? We have a nature, we are a being, we have our own unique manifestation, but there's no unchanging essence within us that has remained the same from the time we were born and will be there when we die and is sitting there experiencing everything or controlling everything. And when we awaken, this can sound a little philosophical or metaphysical or something, but the reality of it is when we awaken to the fact that we're just making all this stuff up about inherently existing self-nature, and that it there is no such thing, and it doesn't matter, like we don't need an inherently existing self-nature, nothing does. It's actually a liberating thing. So in the Heart Sutra, then it says, the Bodhisattva awakening to this, thus their mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So this is all very encapsulated, but essentially when we recognize we have no separate inherent self nature, then there is really nothing that needs to be protected. There's nothing that we need to hold on to or worry about. Our life is just an unfolding process. So anyway, just a little recap on emptiness before we jump in. So I figured we would read the first three paragraphs. They're all pretty short. So as before, I asked for volunteers. Somebody want to read a paragraph? So Judith can read the first one. Anyone on in the cloud?
Yes.
Maybe I've missed your hands.
Glasses. Those reading glasses.
They are. They're not very powerful, I'm afraid.
That's fine. Okay.
How about you, Tyler?
Can
you come up? I'm afraid you have to come up here by this microphone.
I was happy to. I just thought maybe I talked a lot already, but I'll definitely read it.
That's all right. Why don't you do the second paragraph, and then Joan can do the third paragraph.
We say, is that where you want me to start? We say our practice should be without gaining ideas, without any expectations, even of enlightenment. This does not mean, however, just to sit without any purpose. This practice free from gaining ideas is based on the Prajna Paramita Sutra. However, if you are not careful, the sutra itself will give you a gaining idea. It says, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. But if you attach to that statement, you are liable to be involved in dualistic ideas. Here is you, form, and here is emptiness, which you are trying to realize through your form. So form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, is still dualistic. But fortunately, our teaching goes on to say, form is form and emptiness is emptiness. Here, there is no dualism.
When you find it difficult to stop your mind while you are sitting, and when you are still trying to stop your mind, this is the stage of form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But while you are practicing in this dualistic way, more and more you will have oneness with your goal. And when your practice becomes effortless, you can stop your mind. This is the stage of form is form and emptiness is emptiness.
To stop your mind does not mean to stop the activities of mind. It means your mind pervades your whole body. Your mind follows your breathing. With your full mind, you form the mudra in your hands. With your whole mind, you sit with painful legs without being disturbed by them. This is to sit without any gaining idea. At first, you feel some restriction in your posture. But when you are not disturbed by the restriction, you have found the meaning of emptiness is emptiness and form is form. So to find your own way under some restriction is the way of practice.
Questions or comments? Dave.
I can jump in. So in the second bit there, when it talks about, and when you are still trying to stop your mind, that kind of rings a bell, because I feel like everybody who comes to this practice, their first idea is that I'm supposed to be trying to stop my mind. I don't know, do you know where the people get that idea? If that's not something that we talk about, how come everybody seems to have that idea to begin with?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of times meditation is taught in terms of, like, you're given a technique. You're supposed to follow your, you know, count your breath. And when you lose track, you come back to one, or you follow the breath, or you're, you know, most other meditative traditions, honestly, you're concentrating on a mantra, or you're concentrating on a visualization, or you're concentrating on something. And so that, you know, then it's understood, I guess, when your mind wanders off, then you don't want that to happen and you try to keep it concentrated. You know, even in Shikantaza, where, you know, say, aim at the correct posture with body and mind and leave everything to that. It just doesn't feel right or satisfying to just let your habit energy take your mind all over the place the way it usually does, right? Like, what would be the point of that? And silence is kind of nice, right? Some spaciousness, some awareness of the moment, some appreciation of the here and now. So I think it's quite natural, and not even necessarily a bad thing, that we prefer, or that we're kind of trying for. At some point further on, he actually talks about, he says, you know, if somebody's coming to practice and to have something to rely on, they're going through some difficulties, his practice will be concentrated on obtaining emptiness of mind. That means he is trying to be free from the suffering of duality. This is the practice of form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Because of the truth of emptiness, he wants to have the actual realization of it in his life. If he practices in this way, believing and making an effort, it will help him, of course, but it is not perfect practice. So it's like there's something. It's not a bad thing, something beneficial, but there's something limiting to it. So I don't know, I think that's why people are, they just get fixated on the fact that their mind needs to be without thoughts. But it's true that our mind, that we don't want to be just carried away with thoughts. There's something different going on, right? It's not an absence of thought, but I have to be honest, like, my zazen tonight was just thoughts. It was just stupid, lame thoughts, with, like, thinking about TV shows, and I don't know. Like, sometimes it just seems like I, anyway, have, like, no control over what's going to happen when I sit down there, no matter what my intention is. But there is, I think the rest of this chapter tends to talk about this, of, like, when we stop resisting even that, something essential shifts, and it doesn't freaking matter what's going through our head. When we shine the light of awareness on all of that, and then we're right on. Regardless of whether there are thoughts going through our head or not. Ram.
Thank you. I get this part that says, ultimately, it's about your mind pervading your whole body. So, you know, when I'm aware, the thought arises, as soon as I'm aware it arises, and just return to my breath and sit and be peaceful. So don't stop it. It's all good. Whatever is there, and for as long as it may be there, I don't judge it. Just drop it as soon as I'm aware of it and return to just breathing. And I don't think about no mind or no thinking. It's just as much as possible, just simply being with all that is, the sounds, the sensations of my body, the breathing, the consistency of it. And it's simply a very allowing thing. But what I wanted to talk about was how, when I first started doing Zazen in my first Soto Zen period, I sat on the floor in the Zendo with everyone else and during the Zazen Kais and everything else. Of course, and so the big thing was all the pain in the legs and the back and the shoulders and everything else from the extended sitting. And I found that all, you know, having to deal with that. Okay, obviously it's the mind saying pain, 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 you know, and the only way you deal with it is to quit telling yourself that. Now I don't get the pains. I've got this wonderful chair that just completely supports me everywhere I need to be. Great for an old 70-year-old guy, but I'll get an itch or you know, it's, you know, something that calls me to some part in my body. And it just goes back to the same thing. Don't want to make something of that, or I want to return to just this whole everything. So I just try to stay in this very holistic everything place, whatever that is. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. So he says, we say our practice should be without gaining ideas, without any expectations, even of enlightenment. This does not mean, however, just to sit without any purpose. So what purpose should we sit with if it's not about gaining anything? It's not about expectations.
Okay, I gotta. Oh, I'm still on. But I, when you look at the whole Heart Sutra, and it's all just that, know this, know this, know that, no consciousness, no. At the end, don't you want to just say, okay, well, what is? I've just had this big relationship. I just used what is and what I was describing quite a bit. I think, you know, like, you have to kind of come to that question with yourself, particularly after going through the whole Heart Sutra. What is? And I'm kind of thinking, you know, okay, like Zen is, don't speak of what that answer is, because as soon as you do, you're off. You're impugning into it. So it's a very feminine thing. It's all about just accepting all that there is. So I think that's kind of that's the tagline to the Heart Sutra, is to end up and say, come to an experience simply of what is, which maybe consciousness, but not as you know it to be. That is what is. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I'll turn my mic off.
Thank you.
Well, I have a couple thoughts. I don't know if I'll be able to put them all together, but I really like, and he says form is form and emptiness is emptiness, because it just seems to be so simple, and just to get down to what it really is. I mean, it is nothing other than just form is just form. And I was listening to one of your podcasts. It was about no self, but, and you talked about how a chair is just a chair, just as, you know, I am just a person, and then I add this other layer. And I don't remember all of your talk, but what I came to was, so, you know, the chair is just the chair, the moon is the moon, but when you sit in nature and look at the moon, you know, it's, there's something else there, you know, it's just very calm and peaceful. And so to me, I related that to like when I'm at Sesshin and I can just be with myself, I lose all this other stuff, this layers that I, and I'm just there with myself. And it's almost like sitting there with the moon or something. It's just so pure and peaceful. And let's see if I had any other thoughts. That's kind of, that was a real, I've struggled so much with no self. That was a real big kind of like, oh, I can actually grasp that a little bit. And so this, to me, that's kind of what he, when he says form is form, it's like, you know, this is my form and that's all it is. And that's kind of what I get from that. So.
It is a very, it is impossible to really put it into words, you know, it was like, well, but, yeah, I mean, I was reflecting myself on what he meant by that form is form and emptiness is emptiness. And to some extent, this time around when I'm reading Suzuki Roshi, I'm really feeling a lot like I'm reading Dogen, not quite as like poetic and whatever, but in the sense that Suzuki Roshi is always pointing us toward what I call the independent dimension of reality, the absolute, and then the interpenetration of absolute and relative. And the whole goal is like radical non-dualism. And so all the Zen and Buddhist teachings are trying to break you out of your sense of dualism. But then as soon as you use a concept or a teaching to do it, then we can start, like you said, we can start getting dualistic about that. Now I'm form sitting here realizing emptiness. And it almost seems like an inevitable thing. There's a Dogen fascicle where he talks about, I think it's Dogen, in the beginning, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And, you know, you think, I know what a mountain is. There's a mountain. I know what a river is. There's a river. But then you, for some reason, you know, you start to wonder about that. And you encounter the teachings and it says, actually, things are not the way you think they are. And things are empty. And so you start trying to, you know, get your mind around that and open up to that. And at that point, mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. And then, once again, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. Because, like, they just are what they are. Like, they haven't changed. They are empty, but they're not, I don't know, there's just, When I try to understand this, these words and this topic or explain it, you know, it's like my mind just feels like it kind of gets stuck. But when I just, you know, think from my gut and I think about, you know, how there's sometimes you just look at something and just complete in and of itself. It needs no reference points. It needs no excuses. It need not have a purpose. It's just complete in and of itself. And I recall a Dharma friend who many, many, many years ago, like, he had a wonderful insight during session. He was working in the kitchen. He just suddenly looked at this can of tomatoes and just wept. Because it's just like, form is form. Like, what else? It's almost like, you know, in the beginning, we're projecting something, we're projecting onto everything. We're not actually seeing things for what it is. And then our ideas are challenged and we recognize how arbitrary and made up those ideas are. And then it's like we see things for really for what they are, and including ourselves. We experience ourselves for what we really are. Marv, did you change your mind?
I'm still debating. Just since you brought up Dogen, it might be worth mentioning that Suzuki Roshi is paraphrasing Dogen there. His fascicle Magahanya Haramitsu, where he rewrites the first half of the Heart Sutra.
Oh, Dogen.
Which he does for a reason. It seems to me that Suzuki Roshi and Dogen and Zengsan and Faith in Mind, so many great Zen teachers are cautioning against what they call Zen sickness, which you talked about in your podcast on reprehensible teachers and five ranks, that the ones who think that emptiness is everything and you can do anything you want and you just stop there and you deny any kind of phenomenal reality. It seems like so much of Zen focuses on the everyday and things like that, to not deny the reality, not deny emptiness either, but see how they work together.
Yeah. Thank you. So what about this part where he says, when you find it difficult to stop your mind while you are sitting, and when you are still trying to stop your mind, this is the stage of form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But while you are practicing in this dualistic way, more and more you will have oneness with your goal. So how can we practice in a dualistic way and still end up having more and more oneness with our goal? Any thoughts? If you all don't come up with questions, then I'm going to come up with questions.
Well, something gets shaved off with the repetition of the practice. That's what is coming from here right now. I have no idea what it is.
Did cloud people hear that? Judith said it's like something gets shaved off with the repetition of the practice. I'd like to think that this is, well, probably not entirely true. Like Marv was just saying, we can get stuck in emptiness, get up to no good. But for the most part, if we really sincerely continue to engage the practice, we can't do much harm. It's like the practice itself just keeps on deconstructing, taking away. I mean, if we practiced in isolation, which is often what, I wrote that podcast about the frequency with which Buddhist teachers end up doing awful things, particularly like sexual misconduct and stuff. And, you know, and you think, here's this enlightened master, and how does that happen? And And really, you know, and part of it is achieving a certain level of spiritual insight, but then thinking somehow you are such a master that you can mess around with karma and bend moral guidelines because, you know, you're so brilliant and you're doing it out of like compassion and you're helping other people awaken this way or something. And it's just like, but it's, you know, a lot of times these folks have, they've ended up that essentially they are practicing in isolation, even if they're surrounded by people because they have no peers anymore. They're such a guru and a master that nobody's really calling them on their bullshit anymore. So it's a real, you know, a great reason to, you know, maintain connection and community and peer relationships. But so other than, you know, if we continue and we still do receive guidance and we still do have a sangha and engage things wholeheartedly, then I think it's pretty good at whittling away at our delusions. Well, should we read another section?
Tyler,
did you go ahead?
I did, but it was I think it's been sort of part of this in each of the chapters. I feel like this sort of issue has popped up about the practice being like, you know, failing upwards or whatever, like you're consistently going to like fail at this goal, or if you have this goal of whatever, or if you're sitting in a practicing a dualistic way, yeah, it's not going to work. But it is, as you kind of said, like whittling away at it, and you're learning bit by bit through your practice, and with each failure you're able to kind of grow a little bit more if you can hold on to those failures and that sort of thing. So yeah.
All right. So the next two, I was just thinking of reading the next two paragraphs. Practice does not mean that whatever you do, and then when you sit, you should just sit. And ending with, once again, form is form and emptiness is emptiness. So could I have one person to read that part?
And I put a PDF in the chat in case anyone doesn't have the book on Zoom, but they want to do it. They can get it there.
Zoom people, you come in nice and loud and clear. All right, Ryan.
reading both, sorry?
Yeah.
Okay. Practice does not mean that whatever you do, even lying down, is zazen. When the restrictions you have do not limit you, this is what we mean by practice. When you say, whatever I do is Buddha nature, so it doesn't matter what I do, and there is no need to practice zazen, that is already a dualistic understanding of our everyday life. If it really does not matter, there is no need for you to even say so. As long as you are concerned about what you do, that is dualistic. If you are not concerned about what you do, you will not say so. When you sit, you will sit. When you eat, you will eat. That is all. If you say it doesn't matter, it means that you are making some excuse to do something in your own way with your small mind. It means you are attached to some particular thing or way. That is not what we mean when we say just to sit is enough, or whatever you do is zazen. Of course, whatever we do is zazen, but if so, there is no need to say it. When you sit, you should just sit without being disturbed by your painful legs or sleepiness. That is zazen. But at first, it is very difficult to accept things as they are. You will be annoyed by the feeling you have in your practice. When you can do everything, whether it is good or bad, without disturbance or without being annoyed by the feeling, that is actually what we mean by form is form and emptiness is emptiness.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
No question.
Yeah.
What does he mean by bad in that context? When you can do everything, whether it is good or bad. Mm. Talk about doing bad things, or I don't understand what bad means right there.
I mean, I'm reading it as something that might feel bad. I doubt he's talking about going out to do bad things, but something that you experience as unpleasant or
pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah, that's how I read it. When you can do everything, whether it is. Yes, I'm thinking kind of pleasant or unpleasant. So, if you say it does not matter, it means you are making some excuse to do something in your own way with your small mind. It means you are attached to some particular thing or way. That is not what we mean when we say just to sit is enough or whatever you do is zazen. So I was thinking, let's say you go to the grocery store, go shopping, and you intend to be mindful as you do this. You know, because we have our zazen practice, but then we also try to be practice mindfulness throughout the day to be, you know, doing present in what we are doing, aware. But as you shop, your mind is absorbed in thinking about something else, rehashing an argument, worrying about a problem in your life, or anticipating something that's going to happen in the future. So you barely notice what's happening as you shop. Maybe you look at your groceries as you load them into your car and realize you forgot several things. You know, maybe you forgot your card at the checkout counter, or then you notice you did, however, a few things ended up in your bags that you just grabbed out of the checkout line on impulse. They weren't really, you know, much present. So, I mean, should we say it doesn't matter? Does it matter? In what sense does it matter that you just, you know, failed to be mindful during a, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes of your life? Was your grocery store trip mindfulness anyway? Even though your mind was wandering, is that somehow still mindfulness? What does it mean? Whatever we do is zazen. Any thoughts? I have thoughts, but cool.
I'm not sure if this is an answer to that question, but the doesn't matter thing, making mistakes from not being mindful, I was really inspired by your podcast episodes about discipline. And it's definitely like a topic that I'm really struggling with. I know it's like a weak point. But like you mentioned in the podcast, being way too rigid is not a path to success. So when does it matter? You know, trying to be, you know, I did this 30-day, or tried to do a 30-day like vegan challenge. Just like putting food in my mouth without thinking about it. And when does it matter? When you know, and you don't have to be vegan to be a Buddhist. And I can't draw that line. Does it matter at all? And maybe I'm asking the same question as you with using different words, but I don't think there is an answer to that.
I have a perfect, wonderful analogy that I got from Kyogen that I think for me just is the only answer that can be, many of you have heard this before, but it's, he talks about gravity and how we are always in harmony with gravity. we cannot not be. Like, that is just one of the parameters of our world. However, there's a difference between crawling and stumbling around and walking, running, dancing. These are different. You know, it's like if you dancing versus falling down, dancing is not in a way more in harmony with gravity, and yet our experience of it is very different. So to me, I kind of like that image where it's like, I mean, it matters, but it really kind of only matters to us. You know, it matters because we would love to be able to walk without falling down. We would maybe even love to dance a little bit. But there's not really that kind of, you know, that moral should over it then. That's like if we failed to be mindful during our grocery trip, it's like a sin, you know. It's like, and I mean, I really, like, you know, when I would get really dualistic about it, I would think of it as just like that I've wasted my life. I was not present for that. And that was a waste. And it was really upsetting. And yet then it's like, well, what am I trying to do here? Like, practice is making me more miserable than not practicing. So it is a very tricky line there. Betty. Are you there, Betty?
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, I can't. I'm sick, and so I hope you can hear me.
Well, nice to have you here anyway.
Yeah, I'm not going to show my face, though. This is as close as we get. So I'm thinking about, you know, sort of being mindful in every moment. You know, it might not matter, but it might. And it's really hard to know what the karmic repercussions of your activities or actions are. If you don't know what your actions are, you know, if you haven't been mindful in the moment, you don't know what the cause and effect is going to be, maybe until later, if ever. So anyway, that just thought came to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's another level at which, yes, it does matter. It matters in the sense that, you know, if we are more mindful, it means less suffering for self and other. And then he talks about, let's see, what else do we want to cover in our last few minutes here? How about, so in the last three paragraphs, which we won't bother to read, he talks about sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha. And I meant to look that up, but believe in the imagery, it's like this: a sun-faced Buddha lives fucking for a day, and a moon-faced Buddha lives for 100 years or something like that. So Suzuki Roshi mentions this story. Zen master was ill or approaching death, and he, you know, his reflection on it was sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha, kind of like, like Suzuki Roshi says, 1 year of life is good, 100 years of life are good. But in particular, I like, he said, knowing that your life is short, to enjoy it day after day, moment after moment, is the life of form is form and emptiness is emptiness. When Buddha comes, you will welcome him. When the devil comes, you will welcome him. I wanted to talk about welcoming the devil and what they might mean and what they might look like. I mean, I think it's important to note that acceptance and non-attachment, and I think this kind of welcoming the devil thing, It's not about, I like to think of it as, this is about our relationship to things as it is, as to like the way things are right here, right now. It is not about what we're going to do next, right? So maybe we welcome the devil, but then we call the cops and make sure he gets locked up, or we welcome him and, you know, whatever. We have to take some measures to make sure that this devil doesn't cause havoc. But we might, so that's what happens next. This kind of, this welcoming is about non-resistance to, this is where, how things ended up. Here is the devil on our doorstep. But what do we do most of the time, right? Most of the time we think, woe is me. I'm being visited by the devil. Why me? How can the devil do this? The devil should be stopped. Why isn't somebody stopping the devil? He needs to mend his ways. What am I going to do? You know, what's going to happen to me now that the devil has shown up on my doorstep? Just, there's all kinds of, I just think of it as inside we're going, no. But this is what's happening. So what is that when we, what is that non-resistance? How does it feel? How does it manifest? Can you think of any examples in your life where this devil ends up on your doorstep? Whatever it is, right? Like, it's just not something that you want. It's not something fair. It's not something pleasant. We're quite a bunch tonight.
Yeah.
Well, the previous days that we just got through one sentence and that was it.
The thought that comes up for me is, well, it's not about me. Mm. That the devil's here. It's not about me. I didn't do anything to bring the devil here. You know, he's not here to cause me harm. He's just here. It's not about me. And it goes back to this whole thing about no self, and, you know, dropping this, whatever, what is the term you always say, this self that you're always, I can't remember the words you use, but anyway, it's, when I had that insight about, you know, about I'm just me, and just, it's kind of like sitting there with the moon, just sitting there with myself. It opened up this whole thing about, you know, I struggled with my mom a bunch, and it's like, you know what? That's all just about my small self. That's all it is. And I just, it was pretty big for me. Mm. And so that's all kind of tied into that for me. And so that's why I can say for the devil, it's like, he's here, but it's not about me. I don't know.
Yeah, refraining from all of those extra narratives, which are all by their very nature self-centered, right? I mean, it's a great thing to aspire to. It's might be difficult at first, certainly, but Tyler.
Betty, I think, was first. I don't know if she had that before she loses it.
Oh, go ahead,
Betty. Thanks, Tyler. I was just thinking that things like, for me, things like greed and anger and hate and temptation, and like all the stuff that makes me want to like go off the path, you know, and those are the things that I need to welcome, is maybe too strong a word, but at least acknowledge and understand and embrace and deal with. You know, I need to welcome those, kind of like, and like the hungry ghosts, right? You welcome those in so that you can move forward. Anyway, that's all. Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, sorry. I guess that was sort of what I was thinking of in our practice. When we come across things that are challenging or that might be like our devils, we can push them away and pretend, and I think it's a little bit what Betty was saying as well, they don't exist, or we can welcome those things in and say, okay, this is here and this is who I am, and I'm not gonna, you know, things, I can't really ignore it. And that's sort of in our practice, if there are things that are challenging us, welcoming those challenges in and taking them on instead of sort of avoiding them, was where my kind of brain went with it.
Yeah, I think of Thich Nhat Hanh talking about kind of imagining, you know, taking your anger or your fear, particularly your anger, and like holding it like a little baby. Just kind of, you know, holding it like, all right, what is it? What is it? What's upsetting you? What do you need? Just, and ironically, like somehow that actually makes us less likely to be controlled by those things, right? We're more controlled by them when we're just trying to hold them at bay and we're kind of struggling with them, as opposed to, again, kind of like turning the light of awareness on them, right? Everything's different. We say, okay, there you are. Judgment, competition, whatever. So one last question for you. So he says, for the beginner, the practice needs great effort. Especially for young people, it is necessary to try very hard to achieve something. You must stretch out your arms and legs as wide as they will go. Form is form. You must be true to your own way until at last you actually come to the point where you see it is necessary to forget all about yourself. So I guess this is a little like we were talking about at the beginning, how just you can practice in a diluted way and yet it kind of takes care of itself. I think for me, Soto Zen was, I think part of me chose it because it was harder in some ways than Rinzai, because it didn't give you anything to do. And it kept on talking about like the goal of goallessness. You have everything you need already. Just this is it. And it was just like, yeah, but I wanna like, you know, sit and renounce things. And I wanna, you know, try hard to awaken. And I wanna, you know, just wanted to just, like he said, was young and I wanted to just stretch out my arms and legs. And even if it was just a matter of beating my head against a wall, I wanted to beat my head with abandon. And I really, I do feel like I was fortunate enough in practice to be encouraged in that. I mean, there was always a little bit about dance, right? Because you always, we end up with a culture in Soto Zen that's very much like, oh, you're not trying to achieve anything, are you? Oh, like, so you're always kind of like, you know, adding disclaimers and stuff like that. But it just makes me think, you know, just throw out this question, what might you go ahead and try if you weren't at all worried about failure? You know, if you weren't at all worried that, oh, maybe this is delusion to want to try for this. Maybe just go ahead and do. I know that I think I publicly announced at Dharmarine way back when that I was going for the big E. You know, and at some point, like I said, you come to the point where you see it's necessary to forget all about yourself. But we have to each get there our own way, and this kind of effort is not a bad thing. But the best line, of course, the very end, just to continue should be your purpose. When you do something, just to do it should be your purpose. So that kind of ties back to the very beginning, right? He said, don't just sit with no purpose. And yet that purpose, it's like there's no purpose outside of Zazen, right? You're not sitting in order to do something or achieve something. And yet, like, the that's not easy to sit there with no purpose. Even if we're not obsessed with something, we might get bored. And then we just sit there trying to, our mind just sits there trying to amuse itself. To really just sit for no other purpose is profound, profound activity, challenging activity. All right, well, that brings us to the end. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Right, thank you.
Thank you all for coming.